The trip to Egypt symbolizes the shift of power of the Egyptian goddess Isis from Greece to Troy. Egypt was the source of esoteric power which the Greeks had been tapping for centuries. An interesting ritual took place even before Helen departed for Troy. Many Greek heroes had sought her hand before she finally chose Menelaus of Sparta. All her suitors had made a pact that they would support whomever she chose. This agreement was sealed through the sacrifice of a horse. The ritual included the Greek heroes dismembering the limbs of the horse and immersing themselves in its blood. The horse was sacred to Mars, the Roman god of war. The Greek god of war was Ares, and he got short shrift from the Greeks, who portrayed him as slovenly, crude and generally a loser. The Romans and Trojans exalted him. The horse is significant for two reasons. First, its image was used to destroy Troy in the form of the famous Trojan horse. Second, a horse in a ruined city in the year 6037 AD was a focal point in the Montauk Project. People involved in the project claimed they were sent to the future, where they saw a horse on a pedestal that contained some sort of technology. The obvious correlation here is that the Trojan horse involved time manipulation, and there is some information to back this up. Etymologists are uncertain about the origin of the word horse. It is really no mystery. The route hor means time, as is seen in the word horology, which is the science of time measurement. It is also the root for the Egyptian god Horus, who manifests as Montu, the bull god of war. The correspondence between Montu and Montauk is fully discussed in the Pyramids of Montauk. The root hor also is the derivation of the word hor, which refers to the mother goddess Babylon, identified as Kali or as the whore of Babylon in the Bible. She is feared because of her insurmountable powers and potential to devour. There is a book written in Portuguese entitled The Trojan Horse, which is about a time travel project in Jerusalem. Unfortunately, no translation is available at this writing. At this point, I want to refer back to my friend Maya, who offered me information on Project Goala. Her Pleiadian name takes on a more obvious meaning now, and include what she said in her very first letter to me. At the time, members of her mystery school were on a project in Greece and Turkey, where Troy was located, where they were opening old rhombic portals. This what she had to say after reading the Montauk Project: "Certainly I have experienced the golden horse. Thoth tells me that the horse is a time marker placed in a dead zone, where several time waves intersect. He tells me that the Capricorns, those time travelers from the age of Capricorn, I have known about the Capricorns for at least 15 years, have placed these markers in dead zones. They are energetic devices containing incredible energy fields, allowing those whose spiritual force is attuned to the Metatronic or whole light spiral, to enter the marker. Thoth says they are likened to chess pieces in that they contain the moves, the codes of game playing in the universal continuum. If we refer to mythology, we can only speculate on what happened at Troy, but we know that something happened that destroyed a great empire that taught the mysteries. The false timeline carried on." Chapter 37, All Roads Lead to Rome. After the fall of Troy, the Pleiades were not to be outdone. Electra had receded in the skies, but the Pleiad Maia came forward once again and took up roots in the Italian peninsula, where she married Faunus, who was known as Pan to the Greeks. The fact that she chose a horned god was very significant. Her uncle Saturn, who had fallen out of favor with the Greeks, had already settled in the same area, and he was helping civilization develop through agriculture. It was a conspiracy to get back to the original timeline. Saturn is not only the god of time. In astrology, the planet Saturn is the ruler of Capricorn. This is why Maya referred to Capricorns as time travelers in the last chapter. If there is going to be time travel in the universe, it will mythologically be represented by Capricorn, which means horn in the head. More will be explained on this later. On the Italian peninsula, Maya became known as Fauna. With Faunus, she had a godson named Latinus, from which the word Latin was derived. Latinus had a daughter Lavinia, who one day burst into flames as she was offering a sacrifice. Oddly, she experienced no pain. Latinus asked his father Faunus about this miracle, and he explained that Lavinia should await the arrival of a splendid warrior whom she would marry. This turned out to be Aeneas, the only Trojan warrior to escape the fall of Troy. Etymologists are unsure of the derivation of this word. It is related to latus, which means broad, flat land, which is close to the Hebrew word lotus, related to lot, which means key. Aeneas was the son of Venus and was raised by nymphs. He was a relative of Priam and Paris, but did not take part in the Trojan War until Achilles stole his cattle. Aeneas was a brave warrior whose fearlessness led him into many dire situations where he was routinely saved by the gods. During the extinction of the Trojans, Aeneas went to Mount Ida with his father and a few loyal followers. This included the Amazons, who had fought on the side of the Trojans. After the war, he took a 7-year journey and stopped at Crete and Egypt, where he was initiated into the mysteries. Hera was still trying to vex the Trojans and sent violent winds to hinder his journey, but the Pleiad Alcyone came to the rescue by softening the storms. Eventually, Aeneas landed in the area that became the Etruscan Empire, which was based upon the Egyptian mysteries. He later ended up in Latium as king. His descendants were Romulus and Remus, who founded Rome, which was designed to be another Pleiadian colony. The legends of this general time period showed another time god entering the scene in the personage of Janus. He settled in Italy with a fleet, founded Janiculum, and became the king of Latinum. He was the first to welcome Saturn after he had been banished from the heavens. Janus is without a doubt the greatest god of the Roman pantheon, which is remarkable when you consider that Zeus, as Jupiter, was supposed to be the greatest of the gods. Here you have the Romans rebelling against the Greek Zeus. Apparently, they needed a new god, Janus, to show that the correct consciousness of time was the issue. It is all rather remarkable. Janus was depicted as a god with two faces, one heading backward and the other facing forward. This symbolized Saturn's gift to him of double knowledge, which refers to knowledge of the past and future. Janus was also the divinity who watches over doors, because doors have two sides. This has further implications for time as well. Janus was the god of beginnings, and the month of January was named after him. The month of January also includes looking back to the past and forward to the future, a New Year's Eve ritual. He was also a god of the four seasons. Janus was also the real first name of John von Neumann, the Hungarian scientist who was the time doctor of the Montauk Project. The Roman rebellion against the Greek gods is far too subtle to be an accident or merely a different cultural inclination. It had to do with the goddess and time. The Greek civilization had begun to thrive upon the arrival of the Oracle of Delphi, which was known as a female serpent, the Pythoness. Apollo conquered and usurped the Pythoness. After that, it was said that the oracle of Apollo reigned supreme over that of the Earth Mother. After the female serpent was vanquished, the seeds of decay in Greek culture began to take root. The Greeks were known as a patriarchal society and were also notorious for their sodomitic practices, which exactly parallels the experiments done at Montauk. The Pleiadian struggle to put the goddess back on her throne was now underway in Rome. The Temple of the Vestal Virgins was established. There were seven of them, the same number ascribed to the Pleiades. Vesta was a goddess of the hearth, and her symbol was fire. Every city was supposed to have its own Vestal Virgins who would maintain the hearth and its sacred fire of freedom and enlightenment. Rhea Silvia was one of the Vestal Virgins and a descendant of Aeneas. Her father was Numitor, who was the king of Alba. He was deposed by his brother Amelius, who insisted Rhea Silvia live as a Vestal Virgin so that there would be no offspring to overthrow him. The god Mars was a former Trojan ally, and he seduced Rhea Silvia, which resulted in a virgin birth of twins who were named Romulus and Remus. Her evil uncle Amelius put her to death and threw her body into the Tiber River, which was said to marry her. The twin sons were cast adrift in the Tiber in a wicker basket. Fate dictated that a whirlpool deposit the basket on a bank of one of the hills of the future Rome. The twins were suckled by a she-wolf, which symbolizes the bond between animals and the female. The twins soon found other parents and eventually grew to understand their royal heritage, whereupon they deposed their uncle and restored their father to the throne. Eventually, they inherited the throne and unified the Italian peninsula. They founded Rome upon seven hills, which again corresponds with the seven sisters of the Pleiades. Romulus and Remus settled different hills and debated whether their new city should be called Rome or Imra after their respective names. According to the legend, Romulus had built a small wall around the entire city which was easily surmountable. Remus thought this an absurd gesture and jumped over the wall. Romulus considered this an act of contempt and overreacted by slaying his brother. He later felt remorse. This word actually derives from Remus, and gave him a burial with highest honors. This particular myth has some of the deepest implications in our culture. There are various stories written about these twins and their adventures before founding Rome. Some even have Remus surviving, but these versions are very hard to find and have probably been deliberately obscured. The stories of Romulus were often rewritten to suit the political winds of the times. History, even as it related to myths, was a psychological tool used to control the masses. The fact that these twins were of a magical birth by the god Mars brings to light the colonization of Earth by Mars as is described in Pyramids of Montauk. The role of the Pleiades as has been brought out here shows yet another influence. Perhaps more importantly, the most important aspect of this myth is the death of Remus. Romulus went on to rule for a long time even though he had done wrong and knew he was guilty. Their quarrel was all over property boundaries, which is a patriarchal way of looking at things. Remus saw the futility of boundaries and was thus representing the feminine side. Romulus slaying his brother was an act of vanquishing the feminine. That he ruled for a long time has its own implications. The writings about Remus surviving were buried, as was his personage and namesake. It finally emerged in America with the legends of Uncle Remus, a kindly old Negro who was completely non-threatening. He and his namesake were only suitable for bedtime stories. Of course, this was a contemptuous positioning of the black race with the feminine energy. The ruling powers didn't respect either one, which gave rise to a satirical stereotype which subtly expressed their contempt. The etymology of Remus is one of the most interesting I have ever seen. Practically all words in English that begin with rem derive from this myth. Remove, remiss and remnant are a few. The word remit means to send back, but it derives from remitia, to forgive sin. The word remedy means to heal. These words imply that there was a deep sense of loss when Remus died. Remus had chosen the name Rimra for his city. In modern usage, a Rimra is a fish that attaches itself to sharks and fish with an oval sucking disc located on the top of its head. They are known to cling for a long time. This is rather astounding when you consider what happens to a twin when their brother or sister die. The spirit lingers, and this is quite noticeable, especially when the twin dies at birth or in the womb. Such survivors are often haunted by this discarnate being, like a Rimra. A further irony can be seen if you reverse the word Remus. It gives you Sumer, which is the name for ancient Sumeria, featured in the 12th planet by Zachariah Sitchin as a historical center for extraterrestrial contacts on Earth. I saved the best for last. Literally one day before I wrote the final draft of this chapter, a book was sent to me unsolicited, which is called Historical Evidence for Unicorns by Larry Brian Radker. It says the word Re'im in Hebrew signifies a unicorn. Although I haven't read the book, other sources tell me that the unicorn was indeed a real animal who was hunted into extinction because of the aphrodisiac powers in the horn. The unicorn is also the hidden symbol for Capricorn. The spiral horn not only represents the rising Kundalini, but the vortex via the horse, which was discussed earlier with reference to the golden horse. The horn is located over the third eye. Sexual magic is implied with the horn's aphrodisiac powers. Additionally, the unicorn has been used as the symbol for the Christ consciousness in many different myths. The unicorn is not often portrayed in a down-to-earth fashion, although that is his true nature, being a creature of Capricorn. The unicorn brings us back to another time. Perhaps they are not extinct. Maybe someone has been hiding them and waiting for the right time for them to emerge. In any case, the genetic blueprint for the unicorn still exists in the collective unconscious. It is quite evident from all the myths of ancient Rome that someone knew about the original timeline. At least, the collective unconscious hadn't forgotten about it. Rome was designed to be a balanced city on seven hills. When Romulus established the patriarchy, The Pleiadian or the Goala movement, whatever you want to call it, had to take a back seat. The way was paved for the Catholic Church, which does not accept the concept of a priestess between God and man. Even so, the Pleiadians haven't given up. The Vestal Virgins still survive in modern times. They are real people with a real agenda. It seems the Pleiades will continue to shine until we get the message. Chapter 38, The Montauk Connection. In order to fully understand the mysteries that the Pleiades present, we have to consider the sacredness of the bull. We were offered a clue in the legends of Troy when it was said that Paris enjoyed bullfights. Actually, it was his main passion and prime interest in life until the beauty contest came along. Aeneas not only went to Egypt for initiation, but he stopped by Crete too, the home of the Minotaur and the Minoan civilization. The bull was once recognized as a sacred Pleiadian symbol. There are plenty of ancient artifacts, including coins and statues, which link the idea of a sacred bull to the Pleiades. This should not surprise astrologers, as the sun is in the constellation of Taurus when the Pleiades first appear in the sky on May 1st. According to the precession of the equinoxes, the Earth was under the influence of Taurus between 4000 BC and 2000 BC, which gave rise to the solar bull god Mithras and the Minoan civilization of Greece. This was also the period when the legend of the Minotaur arose. The bullfights, so popular in Latin countries, are a legacy from this ancient period. The Catholic Church, who patterned their religion after that of the worship of Mithras, still labels their highest edict a papal bull, which is also the derivation of the slang word bullshit. The Masons regard the Pleiades to be sacred and place these seven stars at the upper end of their sacred ladder. In fact, it has been suggested that the origins of Freemasonry lie in the constellation Taurus. Their T-square is the same as the Egyptian Tau cross, which is thought to have been derived from the face of a bull. Tau is taken from the name Taurus and means bull. The Tau cross is simply a T. It is a symbol of Hermes or Mercury, from which the name Tauti or Thoth derives. The T is meant to signify androgyny. The T is seen as the head of the bull pulling down the crossbar and giving us the traditional cross, sacred to Christianity and many other religions. The bull pulling down the crossbar symbolizes the division into two sexes from an androgynous state. This is the advent of fertility and is the meaning of the bull's virility. The Tau also signifies creative spirit. According to Egyptian tradition, Taurus the bull was the son of Babylon or Isis, or Maya, the Pleiad. As a constellation in the night sky, Taurus was known as the great city of God, the mother of revelations and the interpreter of the divine voice. There is also another Egyptian goddess whose etymology is suspiciously close to that of Taurus the bull. It is Taut, the primeval mother goddess worshipped in ancient Egypt as a pregnant hippo or beast of the waters, of space. She was known as the mother of revolutions because her constellation rotated around the heavens. She embodied the idea of time, repetition, cyclic return, and light in night. The above reveals an obvious link to the word tarot, which means wheel and is said to be the book of secret revolutions of the stars and cosmic time, cycles. This relationship with the word Tau fits in rather amazingly with the word Montauk, which breaks down to Man, Tau, K. Man is defined as God with Tau as per above. The K is just as important in this definition of Montauk. You will see how it corresponds in the following quotation from Kenneth Grant's Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God. The god Montu looks up as you penetrate his realm and gaze upon the secrets of his inner sanctum in ancient Thebes. His patron planet, Mars, shines through the gateway and reflects upon the geometrical processes which represent the matrix of our evolutionary development. K, the last letter of magic, is the 11th letter of several major alphabets. It is attributed to the god Jupiter, whose vehicle, the eagle, is symbolic of magic power in its feminine aspect. It is the symbol of that gigantic power whose color is scarlet, and who has affinity with Capricorn, or Babylon. The special import of Capricorn, the goat, is revealed by its attribution, in the Indian tradition, to the goddess Kali, whose vehicle is blood. K is also the KHN, Q or Q, symbolized by the tail or vagina, venerated in ancient Egypt as the source of great magical power. Magic spelt with a K therefore indicates the precise nature of the current which Therion, Crowley, embodied and transmitted. Several interesting definitions of the word Montauk could be constructed based upon the above. The revelation of the goddess through her manifestation as the illusion of time is one. For those of you who have not read Pyramids of Montauk, there was a bull-headed god on the cover named Menthu or Montu, depicted on the previous page. He was the Egyptian equivalent of the god Mars, an ally of the Trojans and early Romans. The associations between Montu and Montauk are not coincidental. In fact, it was Aleister Crowley's illegitimate son, Amador Crowley, who first pointed this out to me. His father had not only been at Montauk but some of his major work concerned the god Menthu. Shortly after discovering the correspondence between Montu and Montuac, I met a woman who channeled some Pleiadian information for me. I don't even remember what was said except that I had a vivid dream that same night. In the dream, I woke up in an ornate bed and found a gigantic book, trimmed in gold. It was about 6 feet high and was even more ornate than the bed. There were brilliant metallic letters emblazoned upon indigo velvet which read The Secrets of the Pleiades by Aleister Crowley. Unfortunately for me at the time, I woke up before I had a chance to read the book. I would eventually find a clue when I read that the founder of the Theosophical movement, Madame Helene Blavatsky, was born on August 12, the date on which the Montauk Project, 1983, linked up with the Philadelphia Experiment, 1943. I also remembered that Aleister Crowley had been proud of the fact that he had been born in 1875, the same year that Blavatsky founded the Theosophical Society. Crowley had something very interesting to say about Madame Blavatsky. She was extremely popular in her day and was subject to extreme attacks in the newspapers. As the story goes, she was supposedly caught red-handed in staging false miracles for crowds. There were several reports of this sort of thing and you can read about them in various biographies on her. Her disciples have sworn that her miracles were real. Crowley made his own observation about all this. He thought that she deliberately staged phony magic acts so she would get caught. Only in this manner could she get rid of the students and hangers-on that were just there for a thrill. The real students would already know the truth extant in her teachings and would be uninspired by any kind of showmanship. It was simply a way of separating the wheat from the chaff. Once the hangers-on left, real learning could then take place and the cream would rise to the top. I do not personally know whether Crowley's comments are accurate or whether she produced real miracles. Her scholarship is definitely worth reading. Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine is about 1,500 pages and is very deep reading. It is not something I could read from start to finish without entering a monastery for many months. I have noticed a peculiar property about the book. You pick up it up and read it when you are ready to assimilate the information in it. If you're not ready for it, it won't even interest you. The book attempts to give the entire rationale for the existence of the universe and how to understand it. As I haven't read the entire book, I can't honestly critique it, but I would say that it is more than amazing. I have been told that her critics seldom criticize her scholarship but talk about her alleged personal life. Sometimes she has been accused of plagiarism, but this is ridiculous because she is constantly using footnotes and quoting her sources. The Secret Doctrine had some very interesting things to say about the Pleiades, beginning on page 619 of volume 2. There, we learn that the Sanskrit word for Mars, Kartikeya, is taken from Kritika, the Sanskrit word for the Pleiades. This same page gives the account of a Dr. Keneally who indicates that Mars was the most secretive and mysterious of all religious and astronomical symbols. The six viewable Pleiadian sisters, along with the invisible seventh, were needed to complete the initiation into this mystery of all mysteries. We will examine this mystery in the next chapter. Chapter 39, The Pleiades Revealed. The most important aspect of the Pleiades as revealed in the mythology and esoteric information herein is the story of the Pleiad Maia being the mother of Hermes and the Hermetic tradition. This is reflected in the fact that the Pleiades are referred to as the Seven Sisters. There are obviously more than seven stars in the constellation, but the mythographers went out of their way to let us know there were seven, even explaining that one had receded over the Trojan War. The esoteric reference to the number seven neither begins or ends there. Aeneas had a seven-year journey. Rome was built on seven hills. Seven also signifies the generative principle in Hebrew. There are seven heavens, seven chakras, seven musical notes and seven colors of the rainbow. There are even 7 days in a week, representing the original 7 days of creation. Not only does the word Babylon have seven letters, the Babylon working was based upon a seven-pointed geometric glyph known as the Star of Babylon. It may amuse you to know that the world oil cartel consists of seven major companies who are referred to as the Seven Sisters. The entire meaning of seven has to do with what are called the septenary, sept equals seven, influences of creation. Before we can fully appreciate the full import of seven, we have to refer back to what I said earlier about the Garden of Eden being guarded by cherubs and a flaming sword. I will now give you the exact quotation from Genesis 3:24. So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims, and a flaming sword which turned every way, to keep the way of the tree of life. The tree of life refers to the original timeline, of course, but there is also another meaning. The tree of life refers to the mystical Kabbalah or holy Kabbalah, which could be considered a pathway or many pathways to understanding the dilemmas of this universe. In a work of this sort, we can only touch on it very briefly. The reader is encouraged to study the subject on his or her own. The Kabbalah can best be understood as a matrix or interface that exists between the spiritual aspect and the mental aspects of creation. It has also been identified as the basis of your spiritual and physical immune system. What we are concerned with for our purposes are the 10 fundamental emanation points of creation that are represented as spheres or sephiroth. These spheres are a repeating pattern that can be found in nature. The first three, however, are separated from the other seven. The first three spheres are referred to as the supernals, as they are above our ordinary plane of consciousness. These three supernals have Hebrew designations of Kether, Chokhmah, and Binah. Kether, identified in the Orient as the mysterious Tau, represents the divine source from which all things flow. Chokhmah is the positive or male principle, Uranus or Metatron, while Binah is the negative or female principle, Gaia or Mary. As Kether compares to the Tau, Chokhmah and Binah represent Yang and Yin respectively. These primary forces ignite all of creation. The concept of the sacred seven has to do with the different emanations or sephiroth that formed the rest of creation, what we know as the universe. These are the seven fundamental reference points of creation that correspond with the seven chakras. If you study books on the Kabbalah and the chakras, you will penetrate the unseen aspects of existence and see these sevens repeating. It is simply a matter of how the universe is constructed. This is the mystery of the sevens. Obviously, the above is a detailed study. In this regard, this book can only be an introduction to these mysteries or a refamiliarization for some. For those who want to pursue this study further, The Secret Doctrine by Blavatsky will enhance your understanding of these matters considerably. In Aryan mythology, the seven Pleiades were the nurses of Mars, the war god, who is the commander of the celestial armies. The term celestial armies refers to the yogis in heaven and the holy sages of the earth. This equates Mars to Michael the archangel, the celestial warrior who slew the dragon or serpent. This can be explained in simple terms if we realize that the manifest universe is constructed with the Kundalini system. It is not unlike a particular type of software for a computer. We can choose to follow the operating system or not, but it is there. Common Christian think has told us to run from the serpent, but Christ said to be as shrewd as the serpent, but as gentle as the dove. When Michael slays the serpent, it is an analogy for mastering these seven principles of existence. He is the master of all yogis and sages because he knows what they are teaching. Michael or Mars is an ascended master in this aspect. This analogy of the war in the heavens brings us to Revelation. The hidden aspect or invisibility of the seventh Pleiad represents the seventh seal mentioned in the book of Revelation, which refers to the undoing of life as we know it. The esoteric teachings about this aspect of the Lost Pleiad indicate that all the occult secrets exist in a bottleneck that can be released or not. This is the mystery of the seventh seal. It has also been compared to that of the riddle of the Sphinx, which contains access to the Hall of Records.